Support for WPR comes from Present Music, performing honest music with guest violist and curator Nadia Sirota, May 9th at 8 at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Tickets and info are at presentmusic.org.
We've talked on the show in the past about making and crafting things, mainly how-tos and do-it-yourself projects you can do at home. But when was the last time you really thought about why you were making something and what you were getting out of it?
Our next guest is a longtime furniture maker who says the challenging work of bringing something new and meaningful into the world through one's own creativity, whether we're talking about arts or in the kitchen or the marketplace, it's exactly what generates the meaning and fulfillment we're looking for in life. In a new book, he lays out his thoughts about what exactly it means to make something.
Joining us now is Peter Korn. He's the founder and executive director of the Center for Furniture Craftsmanship. His new book is called Why We Make Things and Why It Matters, The Education of a Craftsman. Peter, welcome to Central Time.
Veronica, pleasure to be here.
Well, you've spent more than 40 years in the world of carpentry, taking an idea from a concept to the process where you make it with your own hands and the final product. After all that time, what is it you find magical about working with your hands and building something, making something?
Actually, several things. Maybe the most important one is this experience that one can have, or that I have, of coming up with an idea and then doing what's always the really demanding work of bringing it into the world in a way that matters. It's always a miracle, that you should think of something and then there it should be in front of you. And in the case of furniture, there it should be in front of you, useful and maybe even beautiful. That's wonderful.
A lot of us today, we work in offices, we work in front of computers, and we forget to blink more than once a minute. And you're doing sort of the opposite. I mean, you're thoughtfully working with your hands and conceiving things and making them. What do you think that those of us who don't actually get in there and work with our hands are missing out on?
Well, first, completely honest about who I am and what I do, I was a furniture maker full-time for many years, but I've gone on to do a lot of teaching at the Center for Furniture Craftsmanship and other places. And also, I have a great passion now for writing. So I'm involved in a number of different things and don't feel really comfortable just saying to the world that I'm a furniture maker. That's not how I'm living anymore. But I am passionate about craft, and there's something about working with real materials in the real world that's very different, for example, than the experience I have working at a computer screen in the school office all day. And part of that difference is you actually can see the results of what you do as you do it right in front of you in a way that's lasting and sort of nailed down, if you'll let me say it that way, which is certainly not the case when we're working virtually on things.
Well, one of the things you've been writing about, obviously, is some of the deeper philosophical questions about why we make things, including furniture and anything else people might care to make. And what is your answer to that question? What is the deeper underpinning of what comes of it?
The best way for me to at least begin to explain that is to talk about the personal epiphany that underlies the book, what happened that I'm exploring in the book. And it's this. I became a furniture maker, a carpenter in 1972, and after 2 years started making furniture. And for the first 6 years I was a furniture maker, I sold my work at craft shows. But around 1980, I started showing in art galleries, and that meant I had to write an artist statement. And so the way I best described what I was doing in 1980 in an artist statement was to write that I was trying to make furniture that had the qualities of simplicity and integrity and grace. Now, 10 years after that, I was the program director at an art center, and I was working on another artist statement in a workshop with a critic named Arlene Raven. And in the course of writing that statement, I realized the reason I had become a furniture maker in the first place was that I had somehow imagined that by acquiring these skills and practicing them diligently, I would cultivate more of the qualities of integrity and simplicity and grace within myself. And that led me to see first that for me, really, I was a furniture maker because I imagined that somehow the process of being a craftsman would be transformational to me even more than it was to the wood that I was working with. And by extension, I strongly believed, and now I'm convinced, that really every person who engages in a self-expressive creative endeavor, whether professionally or amateur, their first reason for doing it isn't because the world needs another book or symphony or chair. It's because they expect somehow to learn more about who they are and who they can become and what the nature is of the world around us through the creative process.
And there was a moment there when you surprised your family, wasn't there? You seemed as though you were going to go on to college, maybe to a high-intensity career like your father before you, but you instead chose this other path. Can you tell us what happened at that moment?
Yeah, well, I actually had the good fortune to go to a Quaker high school in Philadelphia called Germantown Friends, and then from there to the University of Pennsylvania, where I majored in history. And after college, I one thing I was sure of is that real life was somewhere else besides in school, and I wanted to try to find it. And I moved to a then quiet place called Nantucket Island in 1972. And the first job that came along was someone offered me a job as a carpenter. In my parents' world, I had never met anyone who worked with their hands. My father was a lawyer and my mother was an historian. And I was under the presumption, and let's put it this way. When I told my dad I was becoming a carpenter and taking a job, he was not a happy man. He felt that it would leave me intellectually underwhelmed as a life, and he was so wrong. And actually, my dad's now 90 years old, and he happily tells me he was wrong, which was great.
Well, let's talk about it, actually. That's really interesting that your dad thought you were going to be intellectually underwhelmed, and instead you found just the opposite, following this path. What is it that you found that engages your intellect and sort of, you know, your whole being as you do it?
Well, starting with carpentry, as a carpenter, you're not only engaging, physical skills, but you're always thinking. There's so much cognitive problem solving involved in figuring out how you're going to go about something, what's the most efficient way, problems that come up. That itself engages your mind quite a bit. But then when I started 2 years later to make furniture, I also started designing the things I was making. And once you start designing, every part of you is engaged, your head, your heart, and your hands in what you're doing. And that, I guess, is another, you asked me earlier what makes craft so fulfilling. It's the fact that every capacity you have is working together in unison to create what you're doing.
Do you think that people who are engaging in making things and craft like you are, do you think they're accorded the respect that they deserve in our society?
No, but then so many people aren't accorded the respect they deserve in our society, starting with school teachers. We value funny things, and I've been speaking about this book all over the country, I'm always interested in the question and answer sessions that happen afterwards. And one thing that comes up just so clear over and over from these discussions is if you are someone who has a creative passion, our society does not provide you with any useful yardsticks for valuing and understanding and explaining to others what you do. Because really, the yardsticks that society gives us are we value things in terms of money and fame. And if you look at the pinnacle of the art world and read about what happens there, what do they ever discuss except for money and fame? And so that's an example. And yet, if you have a creative passion, you know that there are psychological and spiritual and emotional rewards that go way beyond anything measurable in terms of money and fame. But if you're in a career where the rewards are not about money and fame, the society at large has very little way to understand what you're doing or value it.
So as a teacher and a writer now, how do you go about encouraging people who see what you do, who get your message, and who want to engage in creative stuff? What do you do to encourage them?
Just keep yapping. is what I'm doing. That's about it. I mean, that, and we run a school in Maine where we have about 400 students a year. And because of my own outlook, the premise of our education is that even when someone's learning the most basic woodworking skills, they're still designing the project they're going to work on so that they can start to bring that creative part of themselves into play. And what I say to people who are interested and somehow prevented from trying something creative is, you just go do it, and you make mistakes, and you screw up, and that's how you learn, and that's what it's like.
Well, we're talking right now with craftsman Peter Korn about the value of crafting and making things with our own two hands. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you a crafter or a maker? And what about it brings fulfillment to your life? Do you think there is a real hunger out there in the digital world to work with our hands instead of maybe something more abstract? 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking with Peter Korn about why we make things and why it matters.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you make a living by doing some kind of crafting, or is that your hobby? What drew you to that? What do you love about building something from scratch? Call 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org.
And we're going to go to the phones right now. We've got Rhea joining us in Madison. Hi, Rhea.
Hi there. I'm actually graduating from a cabinet making program this Friday. And I never really thought it was possible for me to craft as a profession because I kind of got thrown into the university track. But I'm really excited to be finishing and just designed my own project and finished it. So I'm in complete agreement that, you know, it's the most fulfilling thing I could find to do. So I really appreciated the discussion about the values that we place on careers.
How did you end up making that transition from the college track to cabinetry and crafting?
I actually, it was a little bit of negative reinforcement. I was an executive assistant and found it very unfulfilling. I wanted to build things, and so I just decided to go and do that.
Okay, great. Well, congratulations on graduating this Friday. Peter, what comes to mind there?
Oh, I was going to ask Rhea to give a shout out to the name of her program, but
she's still there, Rhea?
The MATC Cabinet Making Program. Thanks a lot, guys.
There we go. Yeah, and Peter, I read that there are really only three places in the country you can go if you want to learn furniture making.
If you want to learn really, really fine furniture making, there's certainly three top schools you would go to: the North Bennett Street School in Boston, the College of the Redwoods in California, and then the Center for Furniture Craftsmanship, our school in Maine. At least that's my opinion, of course. There may be a few other opinions on that.
And what about these smaller schools that teach things, you know, like Rhea's cabinetry?
Well, one thing is it is really hard to make a decent living as with the dream that many of our students have, which is to be self-employed, work alone, and just design and build one exquisite piece of furniture after another. And a much more practical way to make a living as a woodworker is what Rhea's doing. If she's in the cabinet-making program, she's probably learning what we call architectural millwork, which is where you would make things that were needed by architects and interior designers. So it could be outfitting the inside of a new bar, for example, or replacement windows on a historic house. And it could be kitchen cabinets. And for those sorts of things, you can't outsource those out of the country. There's always going to be work for those things. So she's probably made some good choices.
Excellent. Well, good luck to Rhea. And let's go next to Ariel in Madison. Hi there.
Hi.
Hi, what is your experience with crafting?
So I've been doing crocheting for a long time, you know, crocheting hats and different kinds of things like that. And then recently I learned how to do hand spinning, so to spin my own yarn from wool. And it's been a really, really interesting kind of connection between taking it one step further and kind of learning how people used to, you know, crochet for a livelihood and how to make different clothing. And it's been really fun learning how yarn is made and how it's, you know, comes from animals. And so adding that dimension to crafting, I think, has been really, really interesting.
Okay, great. Well, thank you for sharing that with us, Ariel. And Peter, she's working with her hands with yarn. That's another way to go.
Right. And one thing she reminded me of listening to her is, I'm assuming she's considerably younger than I am, and for me, becoming a carpenter and then becoming a furniture maker was very much a process of creating my adult self, of finding a person to grow into. And so it was a process of self-discovery at the same time as it was a process of discovering the craft itself, step by step. And that's the feeling I got listening to Ariel about maybe what her experience was like at present.
Do you think that's true about any profession that really suits you, that you can grow into it? Or do you think there's something particular about crafting?
No, I think I'm assuming all young people do, or they're looking for a good way to grow into an adult self that they'll want to become. For me, craft, making things with my own hands and designing them, happened to be a great way to do it.
Well, thank you so much for the call, Ariel. And we go to Daniel in Minong. Hi, Daniel.
Hello. In the little RV that I live in, there's a German-made anvil. There are actually two anvils, hammers, and tools to do silversmithing. I create many different things. But the reason why we create objects is it's genetic. It's instinctive. It's in our genes.
All right.
I could not agree more with that.
Really interesting perspective. Peter, do you want to elaborate on that? It's in our genes. It's something humans are meant to do is make stuff.
This is something I find myself saying, because another thing I am hearing all over the country is people expressing something that you said at the beginning, which is, as our daily experience becomes more and more virtual, are we losing touch with some really essential part of ourselves? And the answer, I believe, is yes, and it does not bode well for the future of craft in the society. But on the other hand, human beings have been making things out of natural materials through millions of years of evolution to advance their survival. And that has to be so inbuilt in us. The pleasure we get in doing it, really, it's a kind of joy. And how fascinating and involving it is, how engaging it is. I'm pretty sure that, I agree with Daniel, that is biological and it's just embedded in us.
You know, there's a cartoonist, Linda Berry. She has a national profile, but she lives here in Wisconsin. And we've had her on the show, and she thinks there's something special about the hand, and that when we work with the hand, you know, she's a cartoonist. In your case, you know, you craft, you make things with hands, with your hands. She thinks that it's something that is therapeutic to the brain, and it keeps us mentally healthy. Do you buy that?
I do, and my significant other is an elementary school teacher, and she tells me that current research says that students actually remember more when a teacher is lecturing to them if they're free to doodle at the same time. I think being physically engaged with the hand is, well, again, it's central to what we are and how we evolve.
Let's go to another caller here. We've got Ike joining us from Reedstown. Hey, Ike.
Hi. I've been, thanks for taking my call. I've been a cabinet maker, carpenter for 30 years now. And the last company I worked for, we did architectural millwork. And which is very interesting because all the jobs are different. You know, you don't make the same cabinet again. You don't make the same wall panel. You don't make the same molding. Everything's different. Like one, for instance, a lot of our work was in Las Vegas, but we did the Overture Center, which is quite complicated, and people don't realize how much you have to know to make moldings, to make cabinets. There's a lot that goes into it, and I think it's really underappreciated by people who have no idea what you do, and you try to tell them, and they have no idea what you're talking about. And it's a shame because there's other countries like Germany or the Scandinavian countries who appreciate woodworkers and know, you know, they're well paid and respected. And it's not that way here. The pay is low.
Right. Gotcha. Well, thank you, Ike. And thank you for sharing your experience. We were talking about that a little earlier, Peter, about whether, you know, people who work with their hands are given respect in society. Ike's saying not so much, but it doesn't have to be this way. And I wonder if you actually see maybe a resurgence of respect going back to it, sort of with the new maker movement that's going on right now.
I don't. I mean, I hate to be a pessimist, but I really don't. There's this intrinsic divide, it's called the Cartesian divide, in our society, where things associated with the mind have high status and things associated with the body tend to have low status, and carpentry and furniture making and craft are associated with the body. But there is, in that maker movement, that goes back to illustrating what I was saying a moment ago and also the previous caller, which is people just have such an inbuilt need to make things. And the maker movement is wonderful because it's tens or hundreds of thousands or millions of people who are just rediscovering various crafts for themselves. They're not going to school for it. They're not necessarily looking at what's been done in the past, but they're attracted to it and doing what they can with the materials at hand.
Peter, I want to ask you, listening to you, listening to Ike, and so many of the callers here, it's inspiring to hear so many people working with their hands and getting so much out of it. Is this, do you think, something that anybody can learn? I mean, obviously, there are different routes you can take in to get there, but what about people who just feel like they're not good with their hands?
Yes. Well, the answer is yes. It's something that anyone can do and learn. And running a school, I see that there's a wide variety of aptitudes for this, but there is no one who can't come in to a place like our school and not leave being better at making things than they were when they got there and good enough at it to pursue it in some fashion that's rewarding. So I think everyone has this capacity.
And Peter, in our last 30 seconds here, the rise in technology seems like it could have some pretty big implications for the future of craft. How do you see the role of technology in the world of craft?
Well, we have new tools that have come along in the last decade, specifically 3D printers and CNC routers, all computer actuated. And those are wonderful tools for a craftsperson to add to their existing skill. They let us do some things better. And the only danger is if we get so digitally oriented that we think those are the only means of fabrication. And then I've noticed that the quality of what people make tends to suffer.
Peter, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
It was a pleasure. Thank you, Veronica.
We've been talking to Peter Korn, author of Why We Make Things and Why It Matters.